I'm Rob Sivak, in for Tom Hall, and this is Midday. 20 years ago, an amazing new technology burst into the world. Genetic engineering brought us GMOs and not only transformed the agricultural industry, but also changed the foods you and I buy and eat every day. That's raised questions about the safety of that food and about the wealth and power of an increasingly concentrated ag biotech industry, and about the ability of citizen consumers to determine the role technology should play in our food choices and our futures. Big questions, and we'll try to find some answers when we talk this hour with McKay Jenkins, the Baltimore-based environmental journalist and author of a new book, Food Fight: GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. Shedding some light on the pros and cons of GMOs, Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Welcome to Midday. I'm senior producer Rob Sivak, sitting in for Tom Hall, and I'm glad you're joining us this afternoon. Just drop the term GMO into a conversation these days, and you're liable to prompt an argument, or at least a lively discussion. GMO, of course, stands for genetically modified organism, a plant or animal whose genetic material, its DNA, has been altered using genetic engineering techniques. So what's so special about that? Some argue that humankind has been genetically engineering organisms through conventional crossbreeding since the dawn of agriculture 10,000 years ago. And we know the plants and animals our ancient ancestors first domesticated were very different than the ones being farmed in modern times. What seems to worry a lot of people about genetic engineering today is that over just the past 20 years or so, a revolution in biotechnology has allowed scientists and the giant biotech companies many of them work for to blow past the tedium and imprecision of conventional breeding and to dive directly into the DNA of a plant, animal, or microorganism to move desired traits in or out as needed. The result is that nearly all of four major crops being grown today, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton, are genetically modified high-performance varieties that a majority of farmers in the U.S. and many other countries have embraced with gusto. But this worldwide proliferation of these new GM crops have raised fundamental questions that go far beyond, are GMOs safe to eat? The questions go to the nutritional value and diversity of the foods we buy and eat every day, to the social and economic structures of food production and marketing, and to the quality of the environment in which our food is being grown. McKay Jenkins might be the perfect writer to make sense of this complicated web of science, industry, and culture. The author of 7 books, he's been writing for the past 30 years in various ways about our connections with the natural world. 2 of his recent titles have explored problems in the modern chemical industry. Contamination, published last year, is an investigation into the many toxic synthetic chemicals we encounter, often unwittingly, in our daily lives, and a guide to avoiding them. In 2014, Jenkins published Poison Spring, co-written with E.G. Vallianatos, which examined the disturbing collusion between the Environmental Protection Agency and the chemical industry it was created to regulate. His latest book is the one we'll be discussing today. It's called Food Fight: GMOs and the Future of the American Diet, and it reflects Jenkins' journalistic approach to one of the most polarizing and misunderstood issues of our time. Jenkins holds degrees from Amherst, Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, and Princeton, where he received a Ph.D. in English. He's a former staff writer for the Atlanta Constitution, and he's also written for Outside, Orion, The New Republic, and other publications. Today, Jenkins is the Cornelius Tillman Professor of English, Journalism, and Environmental Humanities at the University of Delaware. He lives in Baltimore with his family, and he joins me today in Studio A. Hi, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to meet you. So let's begin with some definitions, just to create the context. I know that a lot of people listening to this program may be curious about what GMOs are and why there's so much fuss about them. So give us a definition.
Well, you were correct in your introduction to say that there are many people on both sides of this issue that would say that we have been, in fact, genetically altering our food crops for 10,000 years. There's no question about that. If you look at an ear of corn today, it looks nothing like the maize that was first propagated in Mexico thousands and thousands of years ago. Same with the wheat that we all know. So modification of plants is not a new thing. The question, as you mentioned in your introduction, is really the speed at which we're able to do this now with this biotechnology that's happening in laboratories. And the first chapter in this book tries to dispel the first and sometimes only question that people ever have about GMOs, which is, are they safe to eat? That sometimes is really the only thing that anybody wants to know. GMO is a nice little shorthand for people's anxiety about their food. I sometimes think that GMO is kind of the equivalent of MSG. It's a three-letter acronym for something that really stands in for something much bigger than itself. And when people say, I like GMOs or I don't like GMOs, that's often the end of the conversation. And as you mentioned earlier, people are very polarized about this. In fact, there are people that study the way people feel about things like GMOs, and it's like climate change in that it has become almost tribal in the way people feel about it. You know, you walk into the wrong room and say that you think GMOs are a good thing, and you're going to get shouted down and vice versa. So I'd like to start by saying that this book tries to remain as agnostic as possible about the technology. So the technology of taking genetic material from one organism and putting it into another organism, typically from one plant into another plant, is something that can be used for in all kinds of ways. And I should mention right up front that the vast majority of plant scientists that have studied genetically altered plants say that there is no more danger in eating a genetically altered plant than there is in eating a regular plant. Now, if that's all you care about, then you can turn off your radio and go home about your business. But I would like to tell you that there are 350 pages of conversations to have about this issue that are way beyond that. So the consensus, and I'm talking about scientists in the high 90% have decided that eating a genetically altered plant is no more dangerous than a regular one. That said, the conversation opens up from there because in this country, GMO crops are almost always married to synthetic chemical things like herbicides and pesticides that are sprayed on GMOs. And those chemicals are not, in fact, benign, regardless of what industry will tell you. Even things like glyphosate, marketed as Roundup, which is marketed as a soft or a relatively benign herbicide, has been found in studies by the World Health Organization to be a probable human carcinogen. And that is the most benign of the chemicals we're talking about.
Now, in particular, some of these GMO crops have been designed specifically to be used with these powerful herbicides, right?
Correct. So let's go down one of the many rabbit holes in this conversation. So one way to think about this, if I can just give a very brief history, is that after World War II, we soldiers came back from the United States and the Defense Department built the interstate highway system. For the first time, it was built originally as sort of a homeland security system to prevent us from being invaded. And so far, that has been successful. What these highways allowed us to do, of course, was to build massive amounts of housing out in what used to be the country. We had cities and farms. Now we had cities and highways and suburbs. The joke for the last 50 or 60 years is that farms on the East Coast no longer grow food, they grow houses. And we've seen that in Maryland. Maryland alone has lost something like 1 million acres of farms and forests over the last 30 or 40 years. Nationwide, since the 1930s, we've lost 4 million small family farms. So one of the structural things we need to talk about is how local farms have just been obliterated, not because anybody chose that to happen. It's just the way that the infrastructure of the country changed. So suddenly around all these population centers on the East Coast, you no longer had local food production. You had lots and lots of people living in suburban subdivisions. But these people still had to eat. And of course, what that meant was all the food production migrated to these big farms in the Midwest. So that's number one. The number two is, as you mentioned earlier, these chemical companies started out providing chemical weapons and all kinds of things for the Defense Department or the War Department. Monsanto, Dow Chemical, DuPont, these are all chemical companies that were very familiar with using chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. So after the war, they had no longer had that market, and many of these companies turned to the domestic agriculture market and the home lawn care market and started marketing their chemicals to them. So the cynics out there will say that creating genetically altered seeds that turn into plants was a clever way for these chemical companies to create new markets for their chemicals. Now, you can dismiss that. You can be cynical about that. But that is, in fact, one of the structural evolutions, is that chemical companies are now companies like Monsanto, DuPont, Dow. They are some of the biggest seed companies in the world. Many people think that DuPont is a chemical company. They don't realize that they bought Pioneer Hybrid, which is one of the biggest seed companies in the world. So the chemical companies are, in fact, the seed companies. So right. One thing we need to talk about is that.
Yeah, I mean, there's been an extraordinary concentration of this industry. I mean, there were hundreds of seed companies just 20 years ago. And now there are so few, I mean, a half a dozen.
Right. And this is a very interesting thing, because you're talking about the consolidation of economic and political power at one level. And on the biological level, you're also talking about a massive consolidation and reduction in the number of not just seed companies, but in the varieties of foods that are being grown. So if you look at the dramatic crash in the diversity of food crops that are being grown, it would really stun you. And the reason for that, of course, is that when you scale up the production of a very few number of things like corn and soybeans, those corn and soybeans, those commodity crops, can be broken down and turned into a million kinds of processed food, fast food. They can be used to feed some 9 billion animals that Americans consume every year. So what we like, the American food system right now likes to have lots and lots of products made out of very few grains, rather than what it used to be, which is a huge variety of actual produce. The varieties of apples and tomatoes and all that sort of thing has just dropped off the table in the last 50 or 60 years, because we put all our eggs in just the tiny basket of corn, soy, and wheat.
Yeah. A well-oiled machine is how you call it, and quite literally, since a lot of these chemicals are petrochemicals.
Exactly.
Yeah. It raises the question, too, this concentration of wealth and power and the lack of diversity within the industry, about the kind of regulation that it receives from the government. You would think that there would be a whole series, a whole hierarchy of approvals that these companies have to get for every product, whether it's the FDA or the EPA. We don't have too much time. I know this is a complex issue, but what is the regulatory oversight on this new paradigm in the biotech industry?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and without getting too geeky about it, in the early 90s, when it was very clear to both industry and the federal government that GMOs were going to become a very major thing on the American economic scene, some regulators got together and decided that GMO foods would be officially known as the substantial equivalent of non-GMO foods, which meant that they were not going to be subjected to any further regulation. So that was kind of like the decision that the Bush-Cheney crowd decided when they decided that fracking would not be subjected to clean drinking water laws or clean water laws. So they took fracking off the table. It was not going to be regulated. And what the downside of that, of course, is we found all kinds of incredibly dangerous chemicals in fracking fluids. But when fracking came on the line, they realized it was going to be a big thing, and they decided very consciously not to regulate it. The same thing happened with GMOs. This does open up a big can of worms, which we can talk about now or later, which is the influence that this industry has on government, that is to say on regulatory agencies. And maybe in a minute when we talk about Hawaii, we can talk about this. But the companies are very keen on maintaining power in Washington, because that's what they can control. They can't control political movements that happens at the state level or even more at the county or local level. So one of the themes of this book, very strong theme of this book, is that what we need to do for all kinds of reasons is return to local economies, honor and validate local farming, and try to decentralize the food production that we've come to rely on.
Mm-hmm. The federal agency that you would think would be most concerned about the changes that this revolution has wrought is the Agriculture Department. But by and large, the Department of Agriculture has been very supportive of these new crops. They are higher yielding, and they can be financially beneficial for farmers to grow. So they have not really been putting up any kind of resistance to the introduction of these crops, have
they? Oh, quite the contrary. I mean, the USDA, the EPA, the FDA, they are in a very quantifiable way run by industry sympathizers, if not industry veterans. I mean, the revolving door at the top of these agencies, I'm talking about the political appointees, not the staff people, but the political appointees at these major industries, almost universally, regardless of which administration is in town, are veterans of the very industries they are now charged with regulating. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because think about all of the giant conglomerates that depend on what we're talking about. They depend on an unceasing river of cheap grain. They need cheap corn and cheap soybeans to support, for example, the soft drink industry, the fast food industry, the meat industry, the junk food industry. All these industries rely on this stuff. Therefore, the federal policy is going to create an environment where big industrial-scale farmers will keep pumping this river downstream so that we can continue to prop up all these other industries. So in other words, the federal agricultural regulators are not doing everything they could to support local farmers, organic farmers, small-scale farmers, diverse farmers. They're putting all their energy behind these big industrial-scale mm-hmm. farmers because everything depends on that.
Yeah. McKay Jenkins is the Cornelius Tillman Professor of English, Journalism, and Environmental Humanities at the University of Delaware, and a Baltimore-based writer who's been spotlighting the way people interact with the natural world for 30 years. He's the author of 7 books, including his latest, Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. We've got to take a short break now, but when we come back, we invite you to join the conversation. When you're food shopping, do you look for the GMO-free label on the stuff you buy? Are you worried or excited by the way biotechnology is changing our food industry? And do you think giant ag biotech companies like Monsanto and DuPont Pioneer should be doing more with their new food technologies to help feed the world? Give us a call, 410-662-8780. Or email us at midday@wypr.org or tweet us at @MiddayTomHall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm senior producer Rob Sivak in for Tom Hall, who'll be back tomorrow to host another edition of our Health Watch series, Midday's monthly conversation with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. They'll be discussing the potential impact of a new Republican health care bill on federal programs to protect the poor, provide women's health services, and support the fight against opioid abuse. And later, Tom will welcome superstar violinist and Baltimore native Hillary Hahn to the studio. She'll be talking about her current tour and other highlights of a remarkable musical career. That's tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us, my guest is McKay Jenkins, the author of Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. The book is a fascinating and often surprising foray into the revolution in global agriculture that's brought us not only genetically modified organisms, but also profoundly changed the food choices we face every day. McKay Jenkins is the Cornelius Tillman Professor of English, Journalism, and Environmental Humanities at the University of Delaware, and he's penned 7 other books over the past 30 years. Much of his writing has focused on our relationship with the natural world. And, McKay, we were talking before the break about some of the problems with regulating this burgeoning industry, and which has an extraordinary wealth and power. It's consolidated over the past couple of decades. And I think its power and the problems that creates for people who are neighbors forced to be in close proximity to some of their work can be seen in Hawaii, in the Hawaiian Islands. And you spend quite a bit of the book talking about the sort of paradoxical experiences there. And in one case, a success story where GMO crops really saved the island's agricultural economy, and other islands where it's just been a hellish experience for the landowners and the residents of those islands, because there's a lot of toxic chemical spraying going on the experimental fields that these biotech companies are leasing on these islands. Give us a picture of what you found there.
Yeah, so when you're trying to describe a highly complicated story like this, you, as a journalist, you're often looking for little microcosms where all these elements are going on at the same time. So I visited the islands of Kauai and Maui and the Big Island. Now, Kauai is the home. It's the westernmost island in the westernmost state of the United States. And there are a lot of these big corporations that are doing these experimental plots there where they take the seeds, they plant them, and they spray them like crazy year-round to see which ones of these seeds will survive. And then they, when they figure out which ones they like, they take them to market and sell them at very large quantities to the farmers on the mainland. And the problem is that they're using so many chemicals, the quantities are really kind of startling. The people who actually live on the island went to the companies and said, will you please tell us what you're spraying, when, how often, how toxic is this stuff? And the company said, no, we don't have to tell you anything. So the people went to their elected officials and said, would you please force these companies to tell us what they're spraying? And the companies told the elected officials, we're not going to tell you anything. So the people of Kauai successfully pushed through a grassroots effort to get a law on the books that would basically require these companies simply to tell them what they are using. Just disclosure, that's all they were looking for. And they successfully passed this law. The companies sued in federal court saying that these local county laws did not apply to them. And they recently, in the last couple of months, won their case. So in this case, federal law supported companies over local people. Around the same time this was going on the island of Maui, people were very upset about some of these same issues. And they were trying to actually kick these companies off the island. They passed a law with thousands of door-to-door kind of signature-gathering volunteers trying to get these companies to be better neighbors. And the companies, this is now I'm speaking about Monsanto and Dow, they put $9 million into a county referendum. This is a county political issue. If you think about what $9 million of industry money would look like in Baltimore County, for example, this is a dramatic intrusion of corporate money into a local issue. And the people won. Once again, they won. People voted to basically ban the use of GMOs and pesticides on the island of Maui. The companies turned around and sued in federal court, and we're expecting the same kind of result. So we have two cases of local people desperately trying to have control over their own land and companies trumping that, to use a new verb, in federal court. Thus proving, I think, that the federal law is basically there to support companies, not democracy or democratically led initiatives. But the third island that you mentioned, the Big Island, offers a counterpoint. As I mentioned before, nothing with the GMO debate is black and white. There are always nuances here. And on the Big Island, they were having problems with their papaya plantation. There's something known as the ring spot virus that was really completely destroying the papaya plantations on the Big Island. And the farmers there were desperate, and they went to a locally born, very well-known plant geneticist, a pathologist named Dennis Gonzalez, who was a professor at Cornell University, and said, can you please figure out a way to get these papaya to resist this virus? Otherwise, we're going to lose not only the crops, but our entire agricultural economy. So Gonzalez figured out a way to do that. He figured out a way to make papaya plants resistant to this ring spot virus. And now, when I visited just a couple of years ago, the papaya plantations is booming. The fruit are healthy. The farmers are successful. And GMOs have essentially saved that economy. So the point of that story is that GMOs used by, in this case, a nonprofit university researcher to support local farmers is actually a really good use of genetic engineering. It is not being done to support industrial production of high-calorie, low-nutrition food. It's being done to support local farmers who are growing their crops as sustainably as possible, support local economy, support nutritious food. This is the opposite of what you see with the industrial-scale stuff.
Mm-hmm. You know, at the beginning of this biotechnology revolution, we heard from many of these biotech companies that this technology was going to feed the world and that it was going to stave off hunger and famine in developed and developing countries. And we haven't quite seen that kind of promise fulfilled, but there have been instances, and I think even Mr. Gonsalves spoke of the fact that he'd gotten some help in some patent permissions from Monsanto. And he noted also that Monsanto has been involved in developing GMO cassava, which is a basic crop for many African countries. There have been developments along the lines of nutritional fortification of rice in Asia and India. There seem to be at least opportunities for this kind of technology to make a difference in traditional agrarian societies. Has it fulfilled that promise?
The global food economy, the global food system, is an incredibly complicated and ever-evolving entity. So you take, you know, what may soon be 9 billion people, you throw in unknowns like climate change and drought and rising sea levels and the, you know, higher salinity soils, all these different things are making the production of food incredibly complicated. So given that, you know, farmers and researchers around the world are trying to figure out the best way to feed us. That said, there is a lot of disingenuous information being put out by the industry, because when you hear Monsanto say that we need GMOs to feed the world, they really are. They may be putting some money through their charitable wing into some of these nonprofit research efforts, like finding a way to get vitamin A into cassava or get vitamin A into rice. But really, where their profits are coming from is making, like I mentioned before, high calorie, low nutrition grains, or you know, cheap meat, because we're subsidizing all this grain production to feed these, you know, CAFO farms that are creating cheap beef and cheap chickens and all that sort of thing. So it's disingenuous for Monsanto and those kind of companies to say that we're using GMOs to feed the world. What they're really doing is using GMOs to feed us in a very unhealthy, generally a very unhealthy manner. On the other hand, GMO technology, as you mentioned, is being used by nonprofit university researchers to come up with things like golden rice, golden cassava, these crops that can help fend off childhood blindness or childhood mortality. They're using GMO technology to create plants that might be drought resistant or flood resistant. You've got people trying to create grains in places like India where they can survive a monsoon. They can stand up for a couple of weeks of flooding rather than drowning in a couple of days. So again, I want to reaffirm this idea that the technology can be useful, or it can just simply crank up a food system in the United States that is actually really dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that Europeans don't want this GMO food. It's not that they're resisting, you know, enhanced nutrition. What they are resisting is the centralized power of the American food industry. They don't want the food that American industries are providing. They want to maintain their traditions of local food, diverse food, you know, food that fits their traditions, whether you're in France or Italy or Spain, wherever you are. Yeah. They've been eating this way for a long time.
Yeah. McKay, let's take a couple of calls. We've got a number of listeners who have some questions. Tom in Howard County.
Yes, hello.
Yes, go ahead. What's your question?
Oh, wonderful subject matter. Glad that it's being brought up to the population. Firm believer in buying non-GMO products, have been doing that for years, been teaching my family and friends how the importance of buying products with a non-GMO label on them. Mm-hmm. Question is that I was reading in the Epoch Times that there is a new GMO, it's called GMO 2.0, that's going to be coming out. It's kind of been given a different name to kind of elude the public. It's been called CRISPR-Cas9 or Talon, and they're calling it new plant breeding or gene editing. Can you tell me a little bit about the 2.0?
McKay, you've heard of that?
GMO products.
Yeah. Sure. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, that's a good question. So CRISPR is the acronym for a new gene editing technique, which is a very interesting thing because what they're doing is using these gene editing tools to go in and edit the genome of a single organism. This is different from the GMO where you're taking part of the genetics from one organism and putting it into another organism. So you can go in to the genetics of a plant, say, and clip or add certain things from the plant, rearrange things in such a way that you will make the plant behave in a way that you want it to. Now, the supporters of this technology say that it is an incredibly easy and quick way to achieve the same goals that you could find with more, I shouldn't say traditional GMOs. That makes it sound like it's been around forever. I just mean the GMOs have been around for the last 20 years. Cynics will say that this new gene editing technique, because you're not taking a part of a genome from one organism putting into another, you're going to allow it to be renamed as something, because the term GMO has become so toxic that it's become something that nobody wants to see on their food label. Right. So in other words, you can create a food like this and literally, not call it GMO because it hasn't been modified. It's been edited. So you can decide whether that makes you feel happy or anxious. I'll leave that up to you.
And thanks for your call, Tom. We've got a call from Melody in Baltimore.
Hi. My question relates to modified wheat or GMO wheat, and if that has anything to do with what seems to be the rise in gluten allergies in people, and what your thoughts are on that.
Interesting question. I wasn't aware that they had found a GMO wheat yet, or they're working on it.
But Thank you. That's actually a very good question. There is, in fact, no GMO wheat on the market right now. Now, that's not to say that they haven't figured it out. They do have it figured out. And I think the reason we don't have GMO wheat right now is because the public, as you have made all too clear yourself, the public is very nervous about the prospect of more GMOs coming into our really common foods. Like the GMO soy and GMO corn, that stuff was saturating the food market way before anybody had any idea about what GMOs even were. Now we kind of know what's going on, and the companies that have invented this GMO wheat have been reluctant to release it because they don't think people will buy it. Now, your question about gluten allergies is actually a very interesting one. There are scientists doing research on the GI problems that many people associate with the protein found in wheat. And what they are saying is that it's possible that is, it may have something to do with something besides the wheat. And what's interesting about this is that although wheat is not GMO, wheat is often sprayed with glyphosate, this Roundup chemical, which is not just being used in this case as an herbicide. It's being used as what's called a desiccant. It dries the wheat out right before it is harvested. In other words, even though wheat is not GMO, it is still being sprayed with this herbicide right before it's harvested. And there are scientists saying that it's possible that some of the what we call gluten or what we call intolerance of wheat products may in fact be a physiological response to the herbicide, not to the plant. So like I say, we've only been wrestling with these questions for about 20 years, and the research is really just starting to come in now.
Mm-hmm. McKay, we've got an interesting call from Clarence in New Freedom, Pennsylvania. Go ahead, Clarence.
Yes. I garden, and I save my seeds every year, and I dry them out. And in fact, I'm planting today beans and beets. And is this a good idea to keep the chemicals that the companies that do the seeds? I've been doing this for about the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very interesting question and one that comes up a lot when people get worked up about GMOs. Now, what you're doing with saving seeds and drying seeds is what farmers have been doing ever since they were farmers for 10,000 years. We've been saving seeds and trading seeds and hybridizing seeds and picking ones that come from really hardy plants and planting them the next year and throwing out the ones that came from weak plants. Now, one of the problems that Rob actually mentioned earlier today was you mentioned that Monsanto has been very generous in providing relief from patent restrictions when they're talking about GMO technology. The fact that Monsanto has been allowed to patent genes at all is something that drives some people crazy. They think that the idea that a company can own part of a plant's genetic makeup is an absurdity. And what this has meant is that in some communities, farmers are being sued or pursued and hassled by companies for breaking the patent on these crops. So you have, there was actually a very famous case in Canada that I write about in the book where a Canadian farmer had some GMO seeds blow off another farmer's fields onto his fields, and he let them grow and harvested them, and he got approached by Monsanto and said, you don't have the right to those seeds because we have a patent on them. So this whole question about the legal ownership of genetics is very much a part of this GMO debate. And interestingly, one of the Supreme Court nominees who voted in favor of allowing companies to patent genes was Clarence Thomas, who was, in fact, a Monsanto lawyer before he was on the Supreme Court. So there is, you know, this constant revolving door in all these stories.
Thanks for your call, Clarence. McKay Jenkins is the author of Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. Jenkins is currently the Cornelius Tillman Professor of English, Journalism, and Environmental Humanities at the University of Delaware. We're going to have to take another short break now, and when we come back, you're welcome to join the conversation. Where do you stand on GMOs? Do you think the big biotech companies can be trusted with the power of their new food technologies? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 410-662-8780. Email us at midday@wypr.org or tweet us at @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1. WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm senior producer Rob Sivak in for Tom Hall. And my guest today is McKay Jenkins, a professor of journalism and environmental humanities at the University of Delaware, and the Baltimore-based author of Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. As we've been discussing, the book is an environmental journalist tour of the ag biotech industry that's grown up in just the past 20 years and that's managed in that short span of time to radically change the food landscape, not just in the U.S., but around the world. If you have a question or comment about how biotech is changing the food you eat, let us know. Join the conversation by calling 410-662-8780 or email us at midday@wypr.org. McKay, we have an interesting letter here from Jenny Schmidt, who happens to be a farmer that was profiled in your book. And she writes that she's a farmer from the Eastern Shore, and she notes that 80% of Maryland's farmland is no-till, meaning it's not plowed but planted directly into the ground. This is important because the number one pollutant in the Chesapeake is sediment, she writes. Sediment comes from disturbed topsoil. Agriculture has greatly reduced the sediment in the bay by using no-till agriculture techniques. This farming system is made practical by biotechnology GMOs. So the trade-off is tillage versus herbicide. Which one has less impact, she asks. That's from Jenny Schmidt.
Yeah, I'm so glad that she mentioned that. Jenny is a very successful and award-winning farmer on the Eastern Shore, and I profiled her in the book, an entire chapter, actually, because the point I'm trying to make in the book, which she, I think, supports fully, is that the goal is not purity. The goal is sustainability. And if you can use technology in the service of sustainable farming, then you should use technology in the service of sustainability. We're not trying to be pure. We are trying to be sustainable. There are many brilliant farmers out there doing all kinds of things to increase the sustainability of their work, and Jenny Schmidt is a shining example of
and
that.
And specifically, how did she incorporate GMO crops into her
system? She grows a diversity of things. She grows something like 12 million pounds of tomatoes, which if you want to put that in your head, I think she said that she takes 20 tractor trailers full of tomatoes off her farm every day for 2 weeks when they're harvesting. So we're talking about a lot of tomatoes. She grows green beans, she grows wheat, and she grows GMO corn and soybeans. But she's doing it in a way that has won her farm environmental stewardship awards because she's using cover crops. She's using no-till. She's not tilling up her soil. She's using herbicides, which means that she's not having to shred her soil, which would then, of course, drain off into the Chesapeake. So again, I want to emphasize that this book is trying to honor the novel approaches that local farmers, small farmers, are doing to create sustainable food systems. The problem with the large-scale industrial farms that you see out in the Midwest is that if you tally them up, they cover something like 200 million acres of land. Now, 200 million acres of corn and soybeans, no matter how sustainably you're farming them, that's still 200 million acres of monoculture crops. So I have another chapter in this book about a man named Wes Jackson, who's out in Kansas.
The Land Institute.
The Land Institute, a very famous agricultural research institute. Now, they are again, agnostic about GMOs. They don't use them at the moment, but what they're trying to do is create what they call perennial polyculture. They want to model farms after, this being Kansas, of course, a prairie ecosystem. Now, this is a very interesting thing, and this is one of my favorite kind of statistics or visuals in this whole book. If you take all of human existence on this planet as a 24-hour clock, we have been farming, in any way farming, for about 6 minutes. In other words, we were hunter-gatherers for 23 hours and 54 minutes. We've only been farming for 6 minutes, which is the equivalent of about 10,000 years. And Wes Jackson's point is that we made a deal with the devil very early on when we went all in for annual crops that we plant and rip up and plant and rip up every single year. And he says, if you want to solve the food problem, you can forget about all the small-scale produce farms. You cannot feed a global population on organic tomatoes. You've got to figure out the way to provide the world with the 70% of their calories that comes from grain. So you've got to deal with rice and wheat and corn and soybean, sorghum. These are the big-scale, high-calorie crops, and you've got to figure out a way to raise those things in an ecologically sustainable way. So he says, whatever you do to get to sustainability is fine. And if you end up using biotechnology to get there, then that may be what we need to do.
You write in one of the final chapters that there are many local organic farmers who believe that no technology, no matter how exquisite, as you write, can ever replace local people growing food for their own neighbors. That doesn't preclude GMOs from being part of that system, does it?
Well, you can get farmers in very heated conversations about this. Every farmer, it's funny, every farmer I spoke to, whether they were organic or non-organic, got very irritated with Whole Foods, for example, as a place that is constantly putting out these beautiful images of gorgeous farmers with their little fat babies and their little fat melons, and they all look like they came right out of a J. Crew catalog. And they feel like that is doing a disservice to the actual people doing the actual work. This small scale, my family has been part of the One Straw Farm CSA out in Baltimore County for a lot of years. And Drew and Joan Norman, who run the farm, are well-known people around here. They have a fantastic operation up there where we get 6 months' worth of organic local produce for about $500 a year, which comes out to about $20 a week, which is way more produce than my family can eat. So what I would really recommend is that your listeners consider investing their money, honestly, in the local farming economy, no matter whether it's GMO, whether it's organic, doesn't matter, but support your local farmers. That's really the best way you can spend your food dollar. The idea that the Normans talk about, and that lots of local farmers do, whether they're growing farms in the city or out in the suburbs or out in the country, is that reconnecting people with their food is primarily a fundamental thing that we need to do, because every farmer that I spoke to says that one of the problems that we have is that people are utterly disconnected from the sources of their food and the people who grow them. Most people never meet a farmer. Most of, you know, you ask a high school kid, where does a potato come from? And they're likely to tell you that it grows on a tree. You know, now that's an existential problem if you don't know where your food comes from. And farmers will grow what we ask them to grow. They're brilliant people, and we need to ask them to grow the right stuff.
Yeah. We've got Eric on the phone from Baltimore with a question about veggie libel laws. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm on the subject of the relation of, you know, ever more concentrated agriculture to democracy. Those who saw Food Inc. will remember the part about the veggie libel laws. And I just wondered if, I don't know if your book speaks to this, but I find it almost more chilling than the danger to food itself. The the allowance for enormous companies to sue people who make statements, in my view, contrary to the spirit of the First Amendment, people who make statements that suggest the food may not be wholesome.
Right.
Can you speak to that?
Oprah Winfrey was part of a lawsuit?
She won, yes, mm-hmm. yes. But I think others have lost or at least been cowed by the danger of being sued.
Thank you for that call. I'm very grateful for your point. Now, my other hat, besides being interested in environmental humanities, is, of course, I'm a journalist. And, you know, this to me is a really fundamental assault on, as you mentioned, the First Amendment, or if you want to think of it in less highfalutin ways, just simply the right for people to know where things come from. And if you have companies, there are something like 13 states in the United States that have made it illegal for journalists to even take photographs of these CAFO feedlots, for example. You know, you can work on this as a political issue, or you can work on it with your consumer choices. It seems to me what you want to do is give your money to farms and farmers that are open and transparent. They'd say, come on in and take a look at what we're doing. We have nothing to hide. The companies that are saying to you, we are not going to tell you what we're doing. In fact, even if your elected officials tell us that they need to see, we're not going to even tell them. You want to avoid those companies. You want to not give them money. You want to not give them any more political clout. They have way too much already. What we want as a society generally is transparency and openness to the way things are made. And that is true for food. It is true for our consumer products. It's true for everything. And honestly, speaking as a journalist, whenever you get the sense that companies are starting to drop the curtain around things, that's when journalists start to get interested, because it's secrecy that is always a red light. You know, you want to make sure that as a consumer that you are supporting transparent, open production of food.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Eric. McKay, I have a question that sort of picks up on that point, and that is, how likely is it that the power of this of GMO technology and the advances that lay ahead can be liberated from this tight control by a few small group of companies, but this monopoly. Is there an opportunity for either through federal or state funding, university research efforts can carry the ball in a different direction?
It's a very interesting and complicated question. Excuse me, because
we have just a couple of minutes left.
Okay, I'll do my best. One of the criticisms of the way that the food industry is set up now is that, as we've seen, public money for research has been drying up for a very long time. So in other words, you can't just simply apply to the federal government and get big, fat research grants to work on things because the money has been drying up. So where does the money for research come from? It comes from industry. Therefore, industry is dictating the kinds of things that are being researched. So one of the reasons that we don't see huge improvements and advances in things like organic agriculture is there is not anywhere close to the amount of research money available for organic research as there is for this industrial research. So that's a building block of the system, that the research money is there only from these corporations or these industries. Now, another part of this question, though, is what would happen if this technology became so simple and available and inexpensive that, you know, a local university professor could just whip up some cool genetically altered crop and release it out onto the market? Is that a possible? That's kind of like the question of, can you imagine a world where we wouldn't have to depend on the national electrical grid to provide our own power? What if everyone could provide their own power? Like, if you had a radical decentralization of food production, the food landscape would be unrecognizable compared to what it is now.
Mm-hmm. One final question, McKay. Are you okay with eating GMO foods, or do you draw the line?
Well, the way I think about that is I avoid GMOs only in the way that I avoid generally eating what I consider to be unhealthy processed food. I mean, the nice thing about avoiding GMOs, if you're trying to avoid GMOs, is all you have to do is go to the produce aisle, because most of the produce that you're going to find is not GMO, because most produce is not GMO. That said, I want to go back to Jenny Schmidt, though. Like, if you're going to eat GMO food, you still want to be buying it from sustainable farmers. So that's the one caveat, is you want to support the people that are doing the best work out there.
Okay. That's all the time we have, I'm afraid. McKay Jenkins is the Cornelius Tillman Professor of English, Journalism, and Environmental Humanities at the University of Delaware. I'm sorry. And he's the author of Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. And we'll have links to the book on our website, wypr.org/midday. McKay Jenkins, thanks for spending the hour with me. It was fascinating.
No, thanks a lot for the invitation.
I'd also like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guests. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Another reminder that coming up tomorrow on Midday, Tom Hall is back in the host chair for another edition of Health Watch, our monthly conversation with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. As the Senate continues to cobble together a new health care bill, Dr. Wen considers the potential impact on Medicaid, women's health, and the fight against opioid abuse. Then superstar violinist and Baltimore native Hilary Hans joins Tom in the studio. I hope you can join us tomorrow on Midday. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up after the news from NPR. I'm Rob Sivek, in for Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.